Welcome to Reimagining Liberty, a show about the emancipatory and cosmopolitan case for radical liberalism. I'm Aaron Ross Powell. The future of liberalism depends upon the coalitions liberals can build, both to defend institutions now and to reform them when the time comes. As my friend and past Reimagining Liberty guest Jason Kuznicki says, the future is a conversation. So today I brought on two smart liberals with very different ideas about what liberalism means in practice for a conversation about common ground. Matthew McManus is an assistant professor at Spelman College, author of The Political Theory of Liberal Socialism, and frequent Reimagining Liberty guest. Matt Zolinski is a first-time Reimagining Liberty guest on a mission I'm thrilled to rectify. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of San Diego, co-author of The Individualists, Radicals, Reactionaries, and the Struggle for the Soul of Libertarianism, and founder of the seminal but now sadly defunct blog Bleeding Heart Libertarians. This episode is prompted by a review Zolinski wrote of McManus's book, a review that noted their shared values and dug into why, in each of their cases, those values led them to quite distinct policy conclusions. And that's our topic for today. It's a conversation about agreement, disagreement, and how to have productive conversations about liberalism. Before we turn to that, I wanted to let you know there's an easy and free way you can listen to Reimagining Liberty without interruptions from ads and sponsorships. Just head to my Patreon and join Click for free. You'll get a special feed you can add to your favorite podcast app that doesn't contain any ads. You'll also get my new essays sent to your inbox. And if you value Reimagining Liberty and want to support the show, there are options for that too. As a supporter, you'll get all new episodes a full week early. To learn more, check out my Patreon at patreon.com/AaronRossPowell or look for the link in the show notes. With that, here's my discussion with Matt and Matt. Matt, the last line of your review of Matthew McManus's book is, here's hoping his book will be the start of a fruitful conversation. So I figured we'd start there. Seeing as I have both of you, we can kick off that conversation. What is the fruitful conversation that this book left you hoping would transpire?
So I think there's quite a potential for overlap in terms of thinking about how to make the world a better place between libertarians such as myself, especially those libertarians who found some kind of sympathy with the whole Bleeding Heart Libertarian Project, right? People who shared some, I think, the same values as liberal socialists like Matt. I think there's quite a bit of overlap between certain components of the libertarian movement and certain components of the socialist movement, in particular the more liberal forms of socialism and the more liberal forms of libertarianism, because I think there are both illiberal forms of each of those. So I think it's worthwhile exploring where those potential forms of overlap lie, and in particular talking about the ways in which there might be overlaps of both values and policies, right? And I think it's important to distinguish between values and policies, because they don't sort of follow immediately from each other. So one of the points I wanted to make in my review of Matt's book, which is that, from the adoption of a set of values, no particular set of policy commitments follows immediately. You know, the policy commitments that follow from a set of values are going to depend not just on the values, but on various beliefs about the way the world works, sort of empirical beliefs, sociological beliefs, economic beliefs, and so forth. So, you know, it's possible to agree on a set of values without agreeing on a set of public policies if you disagree about some of those other non-value-based beliefs. And it's also possible to agree on a set of policies without agreeing on a set of values, right? I think there can be kind of overlap in support for policies between people with, in some cases, radically different sorts of values. So I think what I'm interested in doing is exploring where those areas of overlap lie and where the genuine areas of disagreement lie, because I think there are some of those too, and where that leaves us in terms of both the philosophical questions that we face, but I think more urgently the practical questions we face about where we should be moving politically.
So what are those values? Other Matt, when you are approaching your project, what are these values that you want to see instantiated in the world or informing our political thinking?
It's funny I got to be Other Matt. A reason being, my sister is married to another man, and he's permanently been Other Matt in our family. So we just keep seeming to sprout that up everywhere. When I was reading Matt One's review of my book, first off, I was really appreciative of it and the deep engagement. But it reminded me of something Heidegger once said, which is that from his perspective, liberalism and socialism were metaphysically the same, right? And he didn't mean that as a compliment, right? They're both ultimately just technical enlightenment philosophies that were focused on the best way to build and the most efficient way to distribute refrigerators. And I actually tend to think that he's onto something with that. I just happen to think that that's a commendable feature of liberalism and socialism, since I'm committed to the Enlightenment Project, rather than seeing that as a reason to dismiss both of them in favor of, you know, in Heidegger's case, Nazism. Today, you know, you pick your flavor of post-liberalism. So I think that what Matt is saying is, broadly speaking, correct. I think that there are anti-Enlightenment forms of socialism that I would never be able to get behind, many of which draw upon similar kind of reservoirs of thought, particularly romantic thought, as the far right. And I think we've become pretty aware over the last couple of years that there are quite strikingly illiberal forms of libertarianism out there. You know, we've talked about the libertarian to alt-right pipeline on the show before, Aaron. And I think that once we've recognized that, the conceptual space between libertarianism as you understand it and liberal socialism as I understand it, I think narrows quite a bit, especially in the aftermath of the Cold War. And that's one of the reasons why I think these dialogues are so important. Now, in terms of how it is that we unpack the shared values that we seem to hold, I think that Matt is right that this is where a lot of the money is going to come in.
When you talk about socialism, though, and I think Matt is correct in flagging in your book that It's a book grounded in philosophy and political theory and values and a normative approach to those values, and that you are tying those into socialism. And I think this is one of the things, like one of the reasons I think I'm excited about this conversation is the point Matt Zielinski makes, that this is ultimately, because there's this shared set of values, you can have really fruitful conversations. Matt, you and I have had our policy arguments, but we like can say we're aiming at, in various instances, we're like aiming at the same thing. It's a question of like, does this world get you there, or this structure get you there, or does that structure get you there? Versus like, if I look out at the people who currently are running the United States, like fundamentally the world they want is anathema to the one that I want. Their values are just basically incompatible with mine. And so we can't have the policy argument because the world they want is in direct conflict with the world that I and the two of you, I think, want to see. So that set of values, what is it? Like, what is it you say? Like, I want to see more of this in the world. I want to see people treated this way. I want to see our perspective on those we share the planet with to look like this instead of that. And therefore, I get to socialism. And, you know, others in this conversation might get to market liberalism or something else. Like, what are those values that motivate you?
By the way, I should say that I like how three philosophically inclined guys struggled to invent different ways of distinguishing between two different Matts through various artificial mechanisms before finally settling on actually, like, let's use the last name. That's nice.
I also just wanted to say, I used to call the what's going on in the Trump White House right now a bunch of people who said, I'm not a Nazi, but, and now it just seems like we've entered into the, well, I kind of am a Nazi, but, you know.
So I think there's a cluster of values here, and it's worth talking about a number of them. But I mean, one of the more obvious ones that jumps out when you look at Matt's really excellent book and look at how that contrasts with some of the things that I've written myself. One of the striking overlaps is an emphasis on individual freedom, right? So both Matts care a lot about freedom. And I think both the most attractive forms of socialism and of libertarianism will place that value quite highly. I also think that's a value that not every variety of socialism or libertarianism values all that highly. And it's more surprising, I guess, in the case of libertarianism, given the name, you would think that a concern for individual liberty would sort of be built into the heart of libertarianism. But my read of a lot of libertarian thought is that there is a concern for rights of property, rights of self-ownership, that in some ways connect with sort of more broadly liberal concerns about freedom and self-direction, but in some ways are quite disconnected from it. And there's a variety of libertarianism that is committed to property rights in a way that seems almost entirely disconnected from more traditional classical liberal concerns with freedom and self-direction. And so I think, you know, we could talk more about how that looks, but I think it's just worth flagging that you can't take for granted that just because if somebody is a libertarian, they're concerned about freedom. And I don't think you can take it for granted about socialists as well, but that does seem to be an area of overlap here. We both want to make people free. And I think one of the things I walked away from with Matt's book was an affirmation of this idea that while libertarians are undoubtedly correct to point to the state as a potential threat to freedom, a serious potential threat to freedom, maybe even the most serious potential threat to freedom, it's certainly not the only threat to freedom. And that libertarians in general have done a bad job of recognizing non-state threats to freedom of the sort that might be found in, say, the workplace, or in oppressive families, structures, or in certain kind of religious forms of organization. Those can have real coercive power over individuals. And if libertarians are really serious about being committed to respecting freedom and not merely to respecting property rights, then that's something that they ought to take seriously as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that what we've realized over the course of the last 100 years is that political ideologies are a lot more mutable than even the average political theorist tends to think, right? There used to be this presupposition that socialism is just one thing, right? Typically a command economy with an authoritarian state. And I think that not only has history disproven that, but certainly in theory, there are a lot of different forms of socialism out there. Similarly, it used to just be assumed that libertarianism or classical liberalism meant just one thing. You know, they're kind of vulgar Marxists that have made that argument for a long time. When actually, what bleeding heart libertarianism really demonstrates is the capacity for this ideology to evolve and change and mutate in different directions. And so there are a lot of different things we could say about this. I just want to focus a little bit on the property issue since Matt brought this up, I think, very artfully. I think that if you're of the view that property is expressive of one's individuality or that personal property is vital for human freedom, then almost any socialist would agree to a certain extent with that, right? Certainly liberal socialists like Rawls or Anderson or Rosselli would say, look, you know, nobody wants the state coming in and taking away your car or your small business or your house or whatever it happens to be, right? On the other hand, if you adopt the view of Curtis Yarvin or Stefan Molyneux, who came out of the libertarian tradition and still sometimes self-identify as libertarians, that the virtue of property is it allows me to be essentially a little lord over my fiefdom, and everybody who happens to enter into my fiefdom does whatever as I tell them. That's highly problematic. And that's the kind of thing that socialists have always been concerned about in terms of allowing mass concentrations of property to aggregate into a few hands. And I think that we're becoming far more aware of just how urgent the need to take this problem seriously is. Now, on the other hand, right, I think that a lot of the socialist responses to this by saying, well, let's just collectively own property by putting it all in the hands of the state has also brought with it many risks of the sort that Matt has brought up, right? In particular, this propensity to lead us on the road to serfdom. But on the other hand, right, I think that there are other versions of socialism that emphasize things like workplace cooperatives, the extension of democratic rights into the economy, which are in many cases quite anti-statist in their orientation. Just to give one example to kind of ground this a little bit, there's a really good book recently by Pelle Dragsted called Nordic Socialism, which talks a bit about the Danish experience with socialism. And he points out that most Danes were actually quite wary of granting too much power to the state. So the way that socialists in Denmark tended to implement their program was through the formation of things like cooperatives, implementing things like high levels of unionization in the workplace. And that's the way that socialism was understood there. And I think that demonstrates how it is that socialism and socialists can evolve to incorporate some of the concerns about excess statism in a way that maybe, say, Hayek, at his most kind of pious, wouldn't necessarily have anticipated they could have.
As you were talking, as the two of you were talking, I was struck by, on this question of property, on this question of value, the last episode of this show was with Zach Woodman, associated with the Center for Stateless Society, about an introduction to left market anarchism, which seems like yet another, like we could have Zach in this room right now and share the same sort of values and arrive at yet another quite distinct set of policy conclusions from, I think, the ones that either of you would hold. And so I want to dig into that. Like, what is it then that if we share these concerns, we share these values, we share this perspective, we share at least in broad brushstrokes a sense of like what it would look like for the world to be better or what it would look like for the world to be worse? What accounts then for the disagreement? Like, one thing that jumps out at me, and Matt Zielinski, I think, mentioned this. Or no, McManus, you brought it up. There's like a differing degrees of skepticism about the dangers of state intervention and control. This is where I disagree with you, Matt, a fair amount. Is like, if we identify a problem, you have the state step in. In my mind, that creates incentives for abuse. It creates various other kinds of incentive problems. It concentrates power in ways that can then be misused. The structures end up being gameable. So people respond to the economic incentives and the results can be directions we would not have wanted when we set them up and so on. So is it just kind of different conceptions of like what the state is good at, what it's for, and what dangers it poses that then lead to these wildly differing? You know, this is the one, if we had Zach Woodman from the Center for Stateless Society here, that would be his main concern is like, no, this thing, if you have it at all, it's too dangerous and it's going to lead to all these bad results. Is that it? Like, or is there something else? Like, why do you guys disagree if you seem to agree on so much?
I think that really here it's valuable to have some insight into the history of Western philosophy and its approach to these questions. So here I'm going to cite Leo Strauss, right? Leo Strauss, in his book, The City and Man, points out that for any antiquarian thinker, the political inequalities and social and economic inequalities that existed between human beings mapped or mirrored the natural inequalities that existed between people. There was just an operative presupposition that people were naturally unequal. And you can see this in Plato, Aristotle. You know, you take your pick, right? Aristotle thought that there were natural slaves, and the best thing for them and for us was for them to be slaves, right? I think that once we hit modernity, equality, or the presupposition of moral equality, at the very least, becomes the operative assumption that underpins a lot of the different forms of Western philosophy that emerge, particularly through the liberal tradition and then eventually evolving into anarchism, socialism, etc. And what anarchists, liberals, and socialists are arguing about, I think, is what kind of society best pays respect to equal individuals and secures the conditions for their liberty. And so ultimately, to your point, Aaron, I think that a lot of these turn on empirical and historical debates about the kind of social form that's most apt for engendering this kind of, or instantiating these kinds of values. Now, one of the reasons why I'm more comfortable with state intervention than you two might be because I'm Canadian, right? And that's just also something that we're more comfortable with there. But it's also because I've seen many kind of instances where the state has played a positive role in securing the conditions of liberty and flourishing for equal individuals, right? Through the decommodification of things like, say, healthcare, right? There was a study done by the Legatum Institute that pointed out that virtually every healthcare system in the world that was in the top 10 ranking was public in some way, shape, or form, right? So I just don't think that there's a really good empirical argument anymore to suggest that a private market in healthcare, let alone a mixed system of the sort that we have right here, is better than some kind of public system that secures health benefits for everyone. But I also think that there are good empirical reasons that libertarians have drawn attention to that demonstrate that there are limits to what the state can do in order to achieve flourishing and equality for everyone. A good example of this would be decommodifying something like the consumer sector, right? It's pretty obvious that the state has not been particularly good at making things like TVs, making things like cars, making things like museums and theme parks, et cetera, et cetera, precisely because these tend to be goods that are much more fungible, right? And people have different tastes when it comes to whether or not they want this TV or whether they'd rather buy a TV rather than ice cream, et cetera. So I think that the best system that we can have is one that achieves the right blend between different approaches to economic organization. And that's why I often point to things like the Nordic states, because they certainly have their flaws. But I think they've done a good job of decommodifying certain kinds of public goods and doing so in an efficient way, while at the same time having quite robust consumer sectors that still produce goods privately, while ensuring that the firms that produce those are managed in a much more democratic way than what we say here through things like co-determination, unionization, et cetera. So from my sake, from my perspective, at least, I'm not dogmatic about the solution to these problems. I don't think there's a silver bullet to how to achieve a free and equal society. I think that there are different spheres in society and that some approaches are worthwhile in one sphere and not necessarily effective in others, perhaps even damaging in others.
Yeah, that's all very good and very, very helpful, I think, in getting at this question of why we disagree. And if just sort of to add my own perspective on it, I mean, I think, you know, you take the two Matts, you take Zach, and you take Aaron, and you ask, like, well, why is it that we see the world in different ways, right? Why is it that we favor or disfavor different policies? I mean, part of that is values, right? So people do have different values in terms of, for instance, solidarity, right? A community is a value that finds expression in the liberal socialist tradition in a way that it really doesn't in the classical liberal or libertarian tradition. Not that it's completely absent there, right? I mean, you can find discussions of community as a kind of voluntary form of organization in classical liberal texts. But I think that's a case where there's a much greater emphasis and perhaps a slightly different interpretation placed on that value within the liberal socialist tradition than within the classical liberal tradition. So there's differences in values, both, again, the weight and the interpretation of those values. There's differences in empirical beliefs. What do you think about the minimum wage studies, right? Do you put a lot of weight on the studies that show that you can raise minimum wages without impacting employment, or do you put weight on the other studies that say that you can't? What do you think about public choice literature, right? So my perspective is that people like Zachary tend to generalize far too much from public choice insights about rent seeking and tend to, in effect, throw the baby out with the bathwater. So I actually wind up with a position maybe closer to Matthew's than to Zachary's on these issues. I think, like, public choice issues are always real. They're always a problem, but they don't automatically undermine the case for any given form of state action that has to be made on a more empirical basis than this kind of a priori one. There's also a kind of methodological question, right? I mean, so how much weight do you give empirical issues in your thinking about political philosophy? So I know a number of libertarians who don't really seem to care that much about how the empirics turn out, right? Because for them, it's mainly a matter of applying first principles to specific cases on the basis of logic, right? So we know the true theory of self-ownership. We know the law and aggression principle. We can work out theories of coercion and consent based on, you know, maybe a little bit more philosophical methodology. And then that gives you the answer. And it doesn't matter whether the minimum wage winds up increasing unemployment or decreasing unemployment or what have you, because we have this kind of rationalistic approach to political philosophy where the empirical facts just have relatively little input in terms of the output that those theories generate. So I think that, you know, one thing that kind of brings Matt and I closer together is our shared commitment to taking empirics seriously, perhaps a shared kind of pluralistic approach to values in political philosophy. We're not trying to sort of derive everything from one master value. We both recognize that there's a plurality of legitimate values that need to be balanced against each other in some non-algorithmic kind of way. And so with the differences in methodology and values and empirics, you can take two people trying their darndest to get at the truth and still winding up, I think, in very, very different places.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd add to that, there's a very good book by Sciabarra, which talks about Marx and Hayek. And from the title, you'd almost expect that immediately, oh, this is going to be in favor of one of these two figures. But what he points out that is a value in both Marx and Hayek's work is precisely the fact that they are empirically responsive to changing circumstances, right? I mean, Hayek had principles that he was committed to realizing, market efficiency, freedom, etc. But he was cognizant of the fact that social institutions are necessary to instantiate those principles adequately, and what social institutions might be adequate to instantiating a free and economically efficient society very well could change over time. And one of the things that Sciabarra points out is that Marx, strangely enough, was committed to quite a similar kind of methodological approach to society, right? I mean, one of the things that he castigated utopian socialists for was precisely that they were not empirically responsive to the fact that, societies change over time, material conditions change over time. They wanted to write recipe books for the cook shops of the future and then say, let's just enact this kinds of blueprint. So all that's to say that I think that any approach to political theory that is so divorced from reality that it just resolutely committed to a priori principles and insist that I'm going to fit society into those a priori principles, whatever people want be damned, is just not going to be to my taste. And I don't think that it's a responsible way to engage in political theory.
We started this by saying this is the start of a fruitful conversation. And all of these reasons that were just given for the varying policy perspectives among the people in this virtual room and everyone else that we might share values with feel like a lot. So like the conversation can be fruitful in the sense that like all of us are weird nerds who like talking about this kind of stuff. And so if we have lots and lots of stuff to talk about and argue about, then that's like good for us. But in terms of, okay, how do we govern? What institutions do we need? What laws, what policies do they undertake? We have to agree on that because we want us as liberalism as a system where at least all of us have some degree of buy-in to this. It sounds like we've now just described an even more uphill battle than a disagreement about values. Because values are like a discrete thing we can talk about and like, no, like it's actually harmful for you to want that stuff about the world and you should change it. And maybe that's a really hard conversation to have, but it's like a bounded one versus what both of you articulated, which is like, well, we got to talk about the empirics of all of these different things. We got to talk about how to interpret various academic literatures. We have to weigh certain interests. Like, that's a lot. And so have we just...
Can you tell we're professors?
Yeah, sure. Yes. But like, how do we have a fruitful conversation in the direction of something like governing, if now the bounds of what I have to convince each of you of to agree with me or what you have to convince me of to persuade me in your direction seem rather vast?
I think there's a lot we can agree on right now, actually, though, and that's that illiberalism is bad and what's going on the illiberal right is pretty terrifying, right? And here I'll, make things difficult on myself for the point of being persuasive by adopting my most Marxist kind of posture, right? A committed Marxist has to recognize the fact that bourgeois democracy, for all its flaws, right, is the highest social form that's been invented thus far. You'd much rather live in bourgeois democracy because it's freer and more equal and more economically efficient than you would in a feudal or aristocratic society. And consequently, when there are people out there like the Peter Thiels or J.D. Vances or the Curtis Yarvins of the world that are postulating a return to an aristocratic society, as a good Marxist or socialist, your job is to sit there and defend bourgeois democracy while also arguing that the problems within bourgeois democracy are part of the reasons why aristocracy can become attractive to people again, right? So I think that we can agree on quite a lot there, certainly in the contemporary moment. The difficulty might lie in how do we diagnose why we kind of arrived at this moment, which is going to lead into what could be the solution to a more sustainable kind of liberalism in the future. But even there, again, I think that there are probably some things that we do seem to be agreeing upon, which is that we have both of our respective philosophies have gone to extremes that are bad and that we should try to avoid in the future. And also that, much like socialists need to recognize that state control can be extremely dangerous, libertarians probably need to recognize that private government or private tyranny or private despotism, whatever you want to call it, is also a danger to personal freedom, and take that more seriously.
Yeah, so 2 points, one of which is simply echoing and amplifying Matt's point, which is that there is a great deal of agreement or potential agreement between the two camps here. I often thought this when I would be teaching political philosophy, right? And I'd sort of, you know, I teach Rawls and I teach Nozick, and you'd sort of frame it as though there was this great debate between these two titans about how to organize the social world. And there is, I mean, there's a lot of disagreement between them, but it's not as if, those are our only two choices of worlds in which to live, right? And in fact, it's not as though the world in which we actually live is either a Rawlsian world or a Nozickian world. It's this third thing that differs from both Rawls's and Nozick's vision of utopia in some massively important ways, right? So to focus in on that kind of narrow philosophical disagreement often, I think, obscures the tremendous area of overlap between their views and the distance between those views and much of what is done in the real world, which today as then is massively unjust by almost any reasonable philosophical standard, right? So we could disagree, we could agree, right, about the badness of anti-liberalism, about the badness of military imperialism, about the badness of sort of blowing people up in boats without trials. We don't need a complex philosophical machinery or agreement about first principles to get to that that point. So that's one point. I think there is a lot of agreement. The second point, right? So one place you can go from the difficulty of resolving these disputes about proper philosophical methodology, about the interpretation of empirical studies, about the correct balancing and interpretation of plural values. One place you can go from all that is to a kind of public reason liberalism, right? And to say that, well, given that reasonable people can and will, for the foreseeable future, disagree deeply about these matters, perhaps that disagreement itself has certain implications for the proper sphere of authority of the state, right? Perhaps the state should not try to take a side in or settle some of these issues out of a respect for the diverse individuals over whom it seeks to rule. Now, of course, that itself can go in a lot of different directions, right? And some forms of public reason liberalism look more classical liberal in their shape, and others not. But that's an alternative route besides sort of frustration and despair that one can take from the intractability of certain kinds of disagreements on these measures.
Yeah, and if I could just add on that, I think that one of the reasons why the gap between libertarianism and, say, Rawlsian liberalism has been sometimes overstated is the fact that, particularly in the Anglosphere, our research and our understanding of the breadth of political views out there has always been pretty narrow, right? So from that standpoint, the difference between Rawls and Nozick looks concurrently pretty big, right? Even though they had a lot of nice things to say to each other, particularly Nozick. I don't know if he could have been much more laudatory of Rawls's book and Anarchy, State, Utopia if he tried, right? But I think once you read somebody like Heidegger, Schmidt, or Nietzsche, let alone, you know, Evola and Bronze Age Pervert and all those, what becomes clear is that there's a lot more in common between Nozick and Rawls than there is between Rawls, Nozick, and whatever kind of mysticism Evola or Dugin is putting forward, right? And those views are very attractive right now, right? You can't just dismiss them and say, well, that's silly or that's not reasonable, because these are people who are, they're not, you know, at the gates. They're inside the city right now and they're trying to take over it, right? So I think that once we respect this and we realize that the gap between these two perspectives is probably less than we made it out to be, I think it can make people a little bit more open-minded about, I hate to sound Schmitty in here, who their friends are and who they can have dialogues with and have respectful disagreements with and who just needs to be confronted.
What changed to get us here now? Because I think that's a good point, that we were operating within this narrower consensus of, like, this is the range of kind of respectable political philosophies, bracket off even like the policies that are within the Overton window at any given time. If you're going to say, I subscribe to this political philosophy, there was a range that were acceptable to talk about in polite company, and you would see represented in departments at universities and so on. But that has changed, as you've acknowledged. And all of these people who at one time we would have said, like, there are people who are studying them, sure, but they're not like advocates of them. They're not embodying them. They're not saying, boy, this Carl Schmitt guy actually like had a lot right. And if we had listened to him instead of these other guys, the world would be a better place. But now we do. A lot of it's outside of the academy. Some of it is inside of the academy. And so for this shared project where, yes, the three of us might have a lot of details to work out, but there's a shared project among us and others who share this set of liberal values, the conversation about what we're up against is very different now than it was 10 or 20 years ago. What happened? Why did we end up in this? Why did these values and policies that are downstream from them lose so much favor with so many people?
I'm going to punt that question to Matt, because for those of you listening who do not already know this, Matt has selflessly immersed himself in the canon of the anti-liberals to a degree that is difficult to believe or fully appreciate, more so than most anti-liberals themselves, I think. Matt really knows what these people said and perhaps has some helpful thoughts on to how they have come to be as influential as they now currently are.
Well, I'll just be a little bit biographical. I think I've been on the show enough to kind of indulge in that, right? You know, I was raised Roman Catholic, and, you know, when I was in my 20s, I read a lot of Schmitt, I read a lot of Heidegger, I read a lot of Nietzsche, and I was very sympathetic to a lot of their criticisms of liberal democracy as inauthentic, base, you know, you pick your terminology, right? And so I think that's always given me a little bit of sensitivity to the fact that there are problems in liberal democracy, particularly emotional and spiritual problems that aren't being satisfied by it, right? What changed for me was realizing that there are far worse systems out there than liberal democracy. And that includes an enormous amount of the systems that illiberal personalities themselves put up on offer, right? And I think that that is one of the major reasons that we are having this discussion right now. I'll never forget there was a National Review article that came out in 2018 where somebody talked about how he used to read, you know, the Dineens, the McIntyres, et cetera. And he thought he wanted liberal democracy to disappear until he realized what was going to replace it. And then all of a sudden he decided that he was a liberal in his heart of hearts after all, right? I went through a pretty similar kind of experience, right? Now, I think that that's one of the reasons for this. Because a lot of people I know share this kind of sense that there are problems with liberal democracy. We haven't responded to those problems adequately. And I think way too many people have decided because of that, that liberal democracy is not a project to be saved, which I think it is, but something to be abandoned, which I think is very much the wrong, even a kind of petulant response in a lot of ways. The second thing that I think has changed is it's no longer the Cold War, bluntly, right? I think that the Cold War produced a lot of, sadly, quite bad philosophy, right? That divided the world into people who support collectivism and people who support individualism, or people who support an open society and people who support a closed society. Now, all these binaries have a certain significance in that context. Don't get me wrong, right? I'd much rather live in the United States or Canada than the Soviet Union, right? But I think when you understand the world that way and you read those categories back into the history of political philosophy, it tends to give you a pretty distorted view of what's actually there and the political potentials that are available to human beings. And I think that now that we've gotten some distance from the Cold War, what we're seeing is both an old and a new set of political possibilities introduce themselves in the public sphere, which is requiring us to take a more nuanced understanding, both of the history of Western thought, and again, of the kind of emotional valences that animate people that go beyond just a concern for what kind of economy we're going to have, whether we're going to have a communist economy or a capitalist market economy. And, you know, I can say that as somebody, you know, who just died, you know, was born right around the time of the Cold War was ending, right? And I'm pretty old at this point, right? And there are people who are a lot younger out there who, for whom Gorbachev is, you know, just not even a distant memory, right? They just have no idea who that is, right? So I think that we need to kind of readjust our expectation about what kind of conflicts are existentially important and which kinds of conflicts can be resolved so that we can confront, as liberals, the more pressing issues facing us right now.
Matt Zielinski, I'm going to kick that ball back to you, though, because you, along with John Tomasi, wrote a couple of years ago, you published a really terrific book called The Individualists, which is a history of the libertarian movement. And you talk about these strains, conflicting strains within it. And so part of it, yes, there's been the kind of right-wing drift that Matt McManus just mentioned, but there's also been, we've seen kind of a split within what used to be the libertarian movement of people who went in the bleeding heart libertarians kind of direction and those who have given up a lot of the commitments to liberalism. Can you speak to that? Like why? Because one part of this story is that for a lot of the people in the movement that you and I have been operating in for a long time, liberalism became less appealing, either authentically or rhetorically, than it used to be.
Yeah. So I think that Matt is right to emphasize the significance of the end of the Cold War. This is something that John and I stress in The Individualists as well, with respect to libertarians, right? So the idea there is that libertarianism in the 20th century context of the United States looked very different from how libertarianism looked in the 19th century United States. And that part of the explanation there was that in the 20th century, the existential threat to freedom was no longer kind of chattel slavery as it was in the 19th century, but rather international socialism. And that was the opposition against which libertarians came to define themselves, right? We are for freedom. The opposite of freedom is slavery. That's what slavery looks like. And so that's what we are against. Once the Cold War ended, once socialism as a kind of international statist political force, right, died and removed itself as a sort of viable opposition to libertarianism, libertarians were sort of thrown into this crisis of identity, right? If we don't know what we're against, we don't know what we're for. And so it's kind of splintered off into these varieties of branches of paleo libertarianism and bleeding heart libertarianism and left libertarianism. And there isn't really any kind of unifying core anymore. I think the same is true of conservatism, of course. Conservatism too was largely defined in the United States in terms of its opposition to socialism, somewhat differently than libertarianism was, but still it had that kind of unifying force. And so after the fall of the Berlin Wall, right after Reagan, conservatives too have been thrown into this kind of crisis where it's no longer clear what it is that holds them together. I was thinking all about this recently. I finally got around to reading this book that a lot of people had been recommending to me, called The Myth of Left and Right by Roland Hiram Lewis, which I think is a very interesting and insufficiently appreciatedly radical book, right? It's basically what they argue in that book is that the political categories of left and right don't pick out any kind of natural kinds. They don't pick out any logically consistent philosophies of politics. What they pick out are tribes and tribal affiliations and people, you know, what it is that unifies these tribes at one particular point of time might be very, very different from what unifies it at a different point of time. But it's a mistake to look for some kind of core of ideological principle that ties everything together, right? Like, this is why conservatives are skeptical of climate change and support gun control and are skeptical of welfare. There's no principle, they say, that ties all that stuff together. It's just that that's what the tribe happens to believe in right now. And it might change in 10 years when a particularly influential tribal leader steps up and says, no, we no longer believe in that. We believe in the very opposite of that. It's no longer free trade that Republicans are committed to. It's the opposite of free trade that Republicans are committed to. That I found a very powerful story. And I think, and I kind of want to write something about this soon. I think much can be said the same about libertarianism as well. I think that, right, you know, we sort of ask ourselves these questions as libertarians, right? Like, what is the libertarian position on immigration or democracy or climate change, right? As though what defined libertarianism was this pure ideological principle. And the only question was, what's the logic of spelling that principle out and deriving the conclusions? Whereas, in fact, I think a lot of what binds libertarians together is this same kind of tribalism, right? We resonate, certain things in the libertarian story or aesthetic resonate with us. And so we latch on to these things as definitive of libertarianism. But when the aesthetic changes, when the context changes, our commitments change too, which is partly part of the reason why you find such a wide variety of libertarianisms emerging and flourishing over time. So that's kind of a long-winded approach to saying that, like, I've grown increasingly skeptical of the power of philosophy and reason to identify a unique worldview that commands assent on pain of illogic. And I've come to think that more and more of what we find in terms of the splits among libertarians or socialists or whoever is largely a matter of competing attempts to sort of redefine the essence of the tribe. And I don't know, I think you need to be more of a sociologist than a philosopher to explain why those tribal identifications change over time, why we've seen such a shift from thinking that Nazism was absolutely beyond the pale, the one thing that everybody can agree on as, like, at least we're not that, to something that we can now sort of at least joke about in, you know, mainstream publications and group chats as maybe not being so bad after all. I don't know how that happened. It's not a matter of philosophical logic. It's something else that's changed.
What does this do then to the project of the three of us and our individual projects? Because so we're all, like, kind of philosophically minded people who tend to think in this system building, start with values and principles and derive from there kind of thing. We're not just picking and choosing grab bags of policies. And we, all three of us, want to move the world in a liberal direction, even if the ultimate endpoint looks slightly different for all of us. And we recognize that happens through a process of persuasion. And so all of us need to be rhetorically effective. We need to be making good arguments. We need to be doing the kinds of things that persuade people. And yet, if it's as you just described, that seems to make our project more challenging in the hopeful sense, like it, at the hopeful end of it, and impossible at the unhopeful. So how do we think about, like, that? Is there a place for the kind of work that we're, the kind of conversations we're having right now, the kind of work that all of us do, if political thinking, ideology, persuasion doesn't happen the way that we're used to engaging in it.
Yeah, I think that Edmund Burke has a really nice metaphor. I don't usually say nice things about Burke, so here we go, right? Where he says, look, if you're the captain of a ship, and sometimes you move left to avoid a rock on the right and right to avoid a rock on the left, people might accuse you of being all over the place, but really you're trying to get to the same destination, right? And I would see all of us as engaged in that kind of project, right? We appreciate the need to be empirically sensitive to context on the ground. We're also aware that the average person, probably for good reasons, is not a political philosopher and is not going to be sitting there being like, well, there's this small, minute contradiction in your first principles or between your first principles and your stated policy. So I'm just not sure I can buy into this project, right? There are a lot of reasons why people adopt political identities, but a concern for Socratic consistency isn't typically amongst them, right? So I think that what we need to do is the best that we can by steering the ship in a liberal direction. And that's going to mean being faithful to our principles while recognizing that actually making those principles meaningful in the world is going to mean adapting them to the possibilities that are available to us at any given time, right? You know, nobody here should want to be Ludwig von Mises, right? And I don't think that anyone here should want to be Comrade Stalin either, right? Neither of these kinds of dogmatic approaches, I think, is the right way to responsibly practice politics.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think you know, politics starts from where we are, right? And it requires meeting people where they are. And, you know, we can do that by looking for areas of shared belief, whether it's shared beliefs about values or empirics. And I think those are more widespread than we sometimes recognize them to be. All right, we can look for areas of shared belief. How we capitalize on that, I think, is there's a role for logic to play. People like to be consistent to a degree. People don't like to feel, you know, pronounced cognitive dissonance. So there's a role for a kind of consistency-based argument in persuading, you know, sort of large numbers of people. It's not going to be of a terribly philosophically consistent, sophisticated source, right? But I mean, you know, the sort of thing that abolitionists do when they point to a picture of, you know, an African-American in chains with the caption, am I not a man and a brother? That's a way of pointing out an inconsistency that you don't have to be terribly philosophically sophisticated to see, but that hits people in a way that makes them reexamine their beliefs. I think conversations of the sort that we're having right now are useful. I think the more of these conversations that people can have, the better. I tend to be very pro conversation, right? I mean, I think so. You know, there was a conversation a few weeks ago between Ezra Klein and Ta-Nehisi Coates about conversations, right? In part, right? So Klein had gotten a lot of flack for an opinion piece that he wrote about Charlie Kirk. Saying that Charlie Kirk was, well, at least the headline that somebody else wrote, saying that Charlie Kirk was practicing politics the right way, meaning that he was going out there and he was talking with people and trying to persuade them. And a lot of people thought that that was very shallow and superficial and wrongheaded on Klein's part, because of course, you know, a lot of the conversations that Charlie Kirk was having were very superficial, very sort of pejorative in nature, not obviously focused as an exercise in truth finding. But so Ta-Nehisi Coates, who was one of the main critics of Klein, came on the podcast and they had a nice conversation about, you know, who we should be having conversations with, right? And who is kind of beyond the pale. And my own perspective on that is like, look, you and I and Matt, right? We all think that there are a lot of people out there in the society who hold beliefs that are beyond the pale in some sense. That are repugnant, that are demonstrably false. But if that's where we are, right? If that's the society in which we live in, if those are the views that people have in our society, then that's what we've got to deal with, right? If anti-liberalism is becoming more prevalent in society, then that's what we've got to deal with. And there are different ways of dealing with it. I mean, you can't ignore it. You can't scream at it and say, this is terrible. You could try to engage with it and show why you think it's inconsistent or incompatible with other values that most people hold. And I don't know that there's one right answer to the best strategy of taking, but I tend to be fairly pro-conversation. I think that having these sorts of conversations can be useful, if not for the parties involved in them, then for the people who are observing the conversations and learning from the conversations, and that blocking people out, writing people off as, you know, these are the kinds of people or conversations or ideas that we don't talk about. I don't think that ends well. And I think that that's at least a part of the story of how we got to where we are today.
Yeah. If I could add one more thing, I think that one of the reasons why people are dissatisfied with, let's call it, mainstream liberalism in the United States right now is because most Americans don't really think that the Democratic Party, let's just use that as an example, actually stands for anything, and that liberals actually have any deep beliefs. Most people see liberals as being at most moralistic, in the sense that we'll talk a big rhetorical game about how important it is to respect freedom, how important it is to respect equality, but then we actually don't follow through on that. And I think that when that's the attitude that a lot of people take towards mainstream liberalism, whether deserved or not, that something like Trumpian-style cynicism can seem very attractive, right? Because why not embrace somebody who's just going to say what he thinks at any given point, or talk about how he feels, whether it's true or not? Why not embrace somebody like Laura Loomer, who's just going to give you permission to say, yeah, I don't like all these migrants here. Hopefully the alligators get out to all of them, right? Which is a horrific thing to say, right? And I think that regardless of where liberalism ends up in the United States, what we need to have are politicians and activists and intellectuals who do seem to stand to something and who are actually committed to that in a non-moralistic way, but in a morally serious way. And to our earlier point about empirical sensitivity, I think that people can often misconstrue being morally principled with adopting this kind of dogmatic attitude towards things. I think that actually being dogmatic is the opposite of being morally serious, because what you're essentially saying is, I don't care if I ever actually realize my principles, I'm just going to hold to them and feel pure about myself. And whether or not they get instantiated or convince people, that's not important, right? Being an actually morally serious person means recognizing that you have a responsibility to try to make the world a better place in line with your value system. And you're going to need to be reflective about the best and most achievable way of accomplishing that, right? And I think that there are some politicians in the United States that have hit that quite successfully. People like, you know, Bernie Sanders and somebody that I find very resonant, or Zoran, right? And I could say that a lot of people who have been interviewed about Sanders and Zoran have said they don't actually agree with a lot of their policies, right? They don't necessarily like socialism. But I like the fact that they are both pragmatic and visionary, is the kind of terminology that I usually see used. And I think that libertarians or centrist Democrats, if they want to kind of regain people's trust, that's the kind of tone and stance that they need to take. I think that this view of liberals as self-righteous and willing to talk a big game but not fall through has been one of the most damaging things for liberalism, and we need to do a lot better and ask better of ourselves.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Reimagining Liberty. If you'd like to listen to future episodes free of ads and sponsorships, you can become a supporter for just a few dollars a month. Head to www.aaronrosspowell.com to learn more.